Say goodbye to birds and bees. Here comes a thing you can't conceive, down in the lab on Christmas morn. Unto us a chest tube child is born. It is immaculately conceived. It must be seen to be believed, the kind of breakthrough you'd expect from the wise men down at biotech.
Goodbye, fairy, cripple, and yet get a clone of your own designer kit. Kids no doting mother ever had created by selected ad. We're the market leaders in the race to privatize the human face. Who cracked the code of the chromosome with a logo guaranteed on every bone. Goodbye, guesswork, fanny or dick, biotech. Select the sex you pick. Mix and match for color and size for the ears of a prince or Einstein's eyes. And if you got a gene the future needs, selected ad'll bank your seeds. If you got a gene that didn't ought to be, there's a free vasectomy rectum. Me. Goodbye, curse of bloody motherhood. Those labor pains are gone for good. There's no danger, there's no fuss with a new designer uterus. Designer girls don't reproduce, they're just for recreational use. Selected for servility with a lifetime money back guarantee. Goodbye, pain and bothersome bugs. Hello to a body with built-in drugs. Hybrid flesh that'll never go bad. Created by selected ad. Selected ad comes to you from the fathers of the atom bomb. Chernobyl, genocide, asbestos, and thalidomide. Oh, goodbye world gone horribly wrong. The march of progress marches on, delivering strength, delivering joy in a blonde and a blue-eyed bargain boy. And if that infant later on says, foster daddy, where did I come from? Say a room, a womb, a white-walled lab, the brainchild of selected ad. Goodbye conscience, chicken and cow, get a burger with that fruity now. This steak culture growing on a shelf, the meat that'll cook and eat itself. There's a Big Mac logo, kids will love, on the wings of a new designer dove. A factory, forest and so much more. No idea what ship's in store. Goodbye, ancient mystery. The call of the world is history. Blue-eyed art, indigenous sperm, with the aid of a smart designer germ. Select the hot shots that we need for a cleaner, leaner, meaner breed. A gene elite in a righteous war to waste whatever was on earth before. Goodbye, evolutionary tree. We have beavered away in secrecy, labored and brought forth the sun. The immortal polymer rise at one with a perfect skin, perfect skill to do his father's perfect will on a world forever in his control, a playground for selected souls. Goodbye, gullible homo sapiens. You believe your deceivers were your friends, just did us to change your lot till you lost the only lot you'd got. Selected ad would like to thank the cream of the cream in the donor bank, and on your mother's grave we swear. Though we have left you in the lurch, we shall not cease from our research, till we can resurrect the toss of the Fuhrer whose idea it was.
Today's third panel is entitled For Whose Benefit? Biomedical Research, and the focus of the panel is on biomedical research, pharmaceuticals, genetic screening, and the Human Genome Project. Dr. Teuscher is the first speaker. He's a professor of medicine at the University of Bern in Switzerland. He also is a founder and was the first director of the Diabetes Center at the University of Bern. His work is in the area of endocrinology, and he has been one of the people in Europe and actually on the world stage who has really been looking at the issue of genetically engineered insulin and the impact that that has had on people with diabetes, not just in his country but also internationally. He also was active in Switzerland. He was the president for 10 years of the Green Party in Switzerland. And so his approach to his subject is both as a physician and also, of course, he brings to it a political perspective as well. So I'm very honored to introduce Dr. Arthur Teuscher today, and I'm just going to turn it over to him now. Yes? Okay.
Thank you, Colleen, for your friendly welcome here. I'm going to give you a really very short lecture on the Frankenstein drug insulin. Human insulin, synthetic, not natural insulin. To start, I must quickly tell you what is diabetes, what type of diabetes, and what is the treatment for diabetes. Type 1 diabetes is a disease which needs insulin for life. If you have no insulin, there is no life possible. Within 48 hours, people die, like they do these days in Black Africa. Type 2 diabetes is a newer type of diabetes expanding very fast because it has to do with our lifestyle, food, exercise, weight, and so forth. I refer to it because 90% or more of people with diabetes have that type 2 diabetes, which in the old times was not treated readily with insulin, but the push of the pharmaceutical insulin to get blood sugars down also in people with insulin resistance has led to the fact that 30 to 50% of these insulin resistant patients get also insulin, and that offers a problem. The aim of treatment is to best be achieved by having control of blood glucose concentration without making the patient obsessional and to avoid disabling hypoglycemia. The dose of insulin is adjusted on an individual basis by gradually increasing the dose but avoiding troublesome hypoglycemic reactions. What I cite here has been written 10 years ago in the publication of the British Medical Association to warn about the new insulin, human insulin. Hypoglycemia is the main problem for all patients receiving insulin. It means too low blood sugar. They get brain symptoms, they can pass out, and in this hypoglycemia it is possible to sleep overnight into death if the insulin is not the correct one. And I may already say here that patients on human insulin have more chances to get into severe hypoglycemic events. They report very frequently they have no warning signs after transfer to human insulin. If a patient believes that human insulin is responsible for the loss of warning, it is reasonable to revert the animal insulin and educate the patient about avoiding hypoglycemia. Great care should be taken to specify whether human or animal preparation is required. The world over, the insulin producers have said there is no difference between human and animal insulins, and I would like to give you now some insight into this, these problems. We measure blood glucose. Patients can measure it themselves. This is a blood glucose which is at 4 millimoles. It's still compatible with good solid life. Down here is 1 millimole. This usually is in a state of coma. So you see that the range is very small from a hormonal action of the body to counteract hypoglycemia through warning symptoms, cognitive impairment, increased brain blood flow, until coma occurs. In 1989, In the 1980s, we had an event in Switzerland that was our insulin supplier, Novo Nordisk, withdrew from 1 month to another animal insulin from their market. We had a market share of 70% of two well-known, well-working animal insulins and had to change to it. Patients coming to our clinic and offices of practicing physicians, they notice, if they listen to patients, that their symptoms of tremor, shaking, hunger, sweating would no more be recognized, as there was no more adrenaline, enough adrenaline to elucidate these reactions. People on the synthetic, artificial, gene technological insulin, they had different signs of hypoglycemia. They had more signs in the cortical area of the brain, but they didn't notice their symptoms until the blood sugar was too low. And it was no more the well-recognized tremor, sweating, or hunger. It was confusion, lack of concentration, sensory disturbances, behavioral changes. So the fall was quite fast to get into a coma situation. Then came that situation, an acute event for me, myself, who have had to change patients from animal to human insulin. That was a 21 years old student of pharmacy. He was very well regulated with his blood glucose. He did experiments with all kinds of insulin. And then that leaflet to physicians came from the Lilly company. Human insulin is better than animal insulin for difficult to regulate patients to have a blood sugar at a normal level. So he wanted to try it out, and with my permission, I cooperated with him. He took it for several weeks. He was quite happy with it. And then one day I came back from a meeting out of another country. I came home and I heard in our department lies this patient. He is unconscious for already more than 24 hours. He has taken the same amount of insulin. He has had a normal blood sugar at noontime. His mother told me the story then. She said, I was in the kitchen, I prepared the food, it was on the table, my son was here, and I said, I have to go downtown, be sure to eat now, that you don't get into low blood sugar. When she came home, her son was flat on the floor, unconscious, brought to the hospital with a blood sugar of 1 millimole, which is no more compatible with normal life. 3 days after reanimation, the patient has died. So I felt guilty that I used a new insulin. It was licensed everywhere around the world, also in Switzerland. I called our agency and said I wanted to have an insight into their licensing document. They said, we don't have any new clinical studies. You know better than anybody else that human insulin must be the best insulin, and so on and so forth. That prompted me to do a study. On 176 patients, I had to change from animal to human insulin because it was no more available. You can see here that 66 patients had hypoglycemia symptoms changed from the classical one I showed you to the low brain glucose symptoms. The conclusion was, in that paper we published in The Lancet, the disadvantage of human insulin is an argument for continued availability of beef porcine insulin. And I show you now further observations. For instance, we asked the Food and Drug Administration in the USA to give us data on events of severe hypoglycemia followed by death or invalidity or other serious interventions. You can see that with the animal insulin from 1969, when FDA started this survey, like for any other drug, to the year 1981, there were few reports on having been admitted to a hospital in unconscious state because of low blood sugar. And then here you see an immediate rise. The higher rise is always the human insulin, and the dark column is animal insulin. So it was a sharp increase and then a drop. Again, a sharp increase, which is going further. So the incidence of severe hypoglycemia is increasing. So when I checked the leaflet of the Lilly company on insulin precautions, hypoglycemia, they said a few patients experience reactions after transfer from animal to human insulin, and they were less pronounced or different from those experiences previous insulin. And you see that death, for instance, is mentioned in that labeling. Despite the fact today, the companies producing insulin, they say there is no difference between human and animal insulin. I will close here and tell you that there is, during 20 years, no paper which shows an advantage of human compared to animal insulin. But the industry has taken great care to manage diabetes associations, diabetic patients, physicians to use only human insulin. They decided that by the year 2005 there will be no more insulin, animal natural insulin available. This is disturbing us very much, and we have taken measures in Switzerland to keep that insulin. And the last word I would like to say, we need to keep safe, cost-effective, natural animal insulin also for the third world countries, because if they die already these days with type 1 diabetes because they cannot afford to buy it, when there is only human insulin left, then we have no chance to take care of these people. And in a country like Canada, where Banting and Best have discovered the insulin, I feel sad that insulin, which was donated to the University of Toronto for no cost or just for a dollar, that these days the industry, which works for profit and no more for health, has succeeded that most people forget that this insulin which is safer should stay on the market. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Teuscher. Our next speaker is Dr. Marcy Dornofsky, who is a research coordinator at the Exploratory Initiative on the New Human Genetic Technologies in California. She has been writing and lecturing on the politics of human genetic modification. And she's also, the focus of her work in the field of biotechnology has been on the effects of human genetic engineering on women and children. I also wanted to mention that there's a publication, a book that's coming out very, very soon on called Redesigning Life, the Worldwide Challenge to Genetic Engineering, which is a great title. I really like the title. She's today is going to be focusing on the what is referred to as the campaign for designer baby technology, and this is a subject that she has written about. And in fact, my introduction to her was precisely about this subject, and her work has been very impressive in this field. So I'm very pleased to introduce Marcy Dornofsky. Thank you.
Big Money, Bad Science is a wonderful title for a conference, and the technology that I'm going to tell you about is one that will, if it is allowed to proceed, make some people very rich, but is being driven right now as much by an ideological vision of a post-human future. And we are now at a moment where there are not direct investments by biotech companies in this technology, so we have a window of opportunity to stop this terrible technology that I'm going to tell you about. What I'm talking about is the genetic engineering technology that would allow people to manipulate the genes that we pass on to our children. Now, most people in the United States, and I suspect and expect most people in Canada, aren't aware that right now there is a very active and aggressive campaign on the part of very influential, prestigious, well-connected scientists and others to promote a dangerous vision of the human future, what they sometimes call the post-human future. This is a vision of a world in which wealthy parents will go to fertility clinics and literally select their children's genes from a catalog. It's a vision of a world in which some human beings, biotech companies, genetic scientists, fertility doctors, design other human beings. It's a world of consumer eugenics, and very likely of the emergence of genetic castes. Now, the advocates of this vision of what we sometimes call a techno-eugenic future insist that it has no relationship at all to past horrors perpetrated under the name of eugenics. And they say that it's not related because this would not be a situation in which there was state coercion. This would be a situation of voluntary choice by parents. So it's consumer eugenics, it's voluntary, not state coerced, therefore nothing to do with any kind of eugenics that we might dislike. And they think that this is a future which will affect not only children and families, but which has a much grander, and they believe to eagerly, something that we should really eagerly seek after, a grand vision of what they referred to as seizing control of human evolution. Now, what they're talking about here is the complete technical transformation of the entire living world. And here's the connection with a lot of what you've been hearing over the last couple years about genetically engineered food and the consequences of genetic engineering in agriculture. This is a vision of a bioengineered future in which plants, animals, entire ecosystems, and human beings are genetically redesigned. Now, it's hard for me to imagine that if we can't win on what I'm focusing on here, if we can't prevent them from genetically manipulating human beings, our children, that we can succeed in a lot of the other aspects of our agenda. It's hard to believe that if we allow the genetic manipulation of children, the design of some human beings by other human beings, that we can prevent the takeover of the food system, that we can protect human and genetic diversity, and that we can be successful in opposing other forms of corporate control. So I think this is one that's a very urgent one that we need to take on and we need to win. And the advocates of this kind of human genetic manipulation are very open in acknowledging that they do think that because the technology will always be expensive, it will be used by the wealthy, and that it will lead to the emergence of genetic castes. They even talk about perhaps the emergence of different species. They're talking about the end of our common humanity. But they say that this is inevitable. And that's the message we have to combat. And before I go any further, let me stop for a moment and make a technical distinction that will let you evaluate a lot of what you're going to start to be reading more and more about in newspapers and magazines and hearing on television. And that technical distinction is between two kinds of human genetic engineering. The first kind is technically known as somatic genetic engineering. And that's what, when you hear about gene therapy, about clinical trials of gene therapy, what they're talking about is somatic genetic engineering. Now, there's a lot of questions to ask and regulations that need to be put in place on gene therapy or somatic genetic engineering. What it does is the intent of it is to treat a person who is affected by a gene-related disorder. So it targets an existing human being, and it targets particular tissues or organs of that person. So, for example, somebody affected by cystic fibrosis would get a gene therapy treatment that was targeted at that person's lungs. And somatic genetic engineering, or gene therapy, some people say it should be called genetic experiments on human subjects, has a lot to answer for. Experiments have been going on for about 10 years, something like 500 clinical trials, and they have not been terribly successful. And in addition to the questions about effectiveness, we have to ask questions about its safety. Just over a year ago, a young man in the United States died as a result of being treated in one of these trials, and the subsequent investigations revealed all kinds of scandals, lack of informed consent, financial entanglements between the principal investigator in this trial and the company that stood to make a lot of money, and so on. The same is true of a lot of the other technologies that would be involved with this designer baby vision. And what I mean by the same is there are questions of safety, there are questions of ethics having to do with access, having to do with medical priorities, and having to do with eugenics. Now, many people who can work together as allies will disagree on particular technologies, and Gregor's going to tell you about some of those disagreements. But I think whatever the questions we have about somatic genetic engineering, they need to be on one side of a line. Some of those technologies we may decide to forego. But there's a line that can be drawn very clearly. And on the other side of that line, the place where we really need to ban people from going is the technology that we call germline, human germline engineering. It's called germline because it targets not an existing person, but a future person. Germline refers to the germ cells, the egg or the sperm cells. In practice, germline engineering is usually carried out on a very early embryo. And it is not about treating someone who has problems with a gene-related condition. It's about putting new traits into a future child. Now, many people, understandably, are reluctant to oppose human germline engineering because they have been led to believe that it can be used to treat or to prevent serious gene-related diseases. But that claim is quite misleading. When you really look at the technology, starting with the fact that it has nothing to do with treating existing people, you see that there really is no convincing medical justification for it. And the risks, both the physical risks of what these attempts to manipulate an early human embryo might result in, and the social risks are enormous. Until a few years ago, people who advocated, scientists and others who advocated this kind of genetic engineering, human germline engineering, presented it as a therapy, as a medical treatment, and they strained to come up with arguments that would be convincing. But that situation has really changed, and now they openly celebrate the idea of enhancing human beings. And really, in fact, human germline engineering is only necessary if you're talking about enhancing a future child. Now, these advocates are quite explicit both about what they want to accomplish technically and what they think the political effects of it will be. So many of them predict that in the near term, we, meaning they, will be able to manipulate a future child's hair, eye, skin color, life expectancy to give a child larger and more efficient muscles. And they go on and on with all the traits and characteristics they might be able to change. They think they will be able to change. They say that a little bit down the line, they will be able to let a parent choose a child's personality, docile or aggressive. And they always talk about engineering greater intelligence, whatever they might mean by that. Some of them, I mean, these are scientists. These are people with posts at prestigious universities, and they somehow think it's okay for them to go out on these limbs. And some of them publicly say that they will be able to splice into a human child traits from other species. They talk about putting in super sensitive hearing from a dog or night vision from an owl. Now, we know, because we know that human beings are so much more than the product of genes, that some or many of these feats are not likely to be possible. And that, you know, if they are allowed to try to do these kinds of things, we might see some really tragic results. But it's important, while we insist that we are not just the product of our genes, that we also take seriously the possibility that genetic scientists will be able to achieve enough of what they want to achieve, enough mastery over the human genome, that they will wreak enormous damage, both biologically and politically. I want to tell you about one of these scientists. His name is Lee Silver. He's a mouse geneticist at Princeton University, right in the mainstream of science. And he's written a book called Remaking Eden. The subtitle is Human Cloning and Beyond in the Brave New World. It came out in 1997. And what Silver likes to do, or what he does in the prologue of this book, is to spin out scenarios of what the future will look like in a few hundred years, he says, if we go down this road toward human germline engineering. And here's a short quote from the prologue of his book, Remaking Eden. He says, in a few hundred years, the genetically rich, or the gen rich, who account for 10% of the American population, will all carry synthetic genes. All aspects of the economy, the media, the entertainment industry, and the knowledge industry will be controlled by members of this gen rich class. Naturals, the unenhanced, will work as low paid service providers or as laborers. A few paragraphs later, he says, eventually, the gen-rich class and the natural class will become entirely separate species with no ability to crossbreed and with as much romantic interest in each other as a current human would have for a chimpanzee. And he ends the prologue saying, in a society that values individual freedom above all else, it's hard to find any legitimate basis for restricting the use of reprogenetics. The use of reprogenetic technologies is inevitable. There is no doubt about it. Whether we like it or not, the global marketplace will reign supreme. So, I came across this book. I read it. I was just stunned. It was really hard to believe that that a guy with that kind of credential could be saying these kinds of things, and whatever the biological feasibility, the political effects of such statements are horribly pernicious. But I managed to convince myself that, you know, I didn't have to really take it too seriously. I thought, oh, you know, here's this guy, he's a mouse geneticist, he stays in his lab all day, comes home at night, sits down at the computer, and he pounds out these scenarios, he lets himself indulge in mad scientist mode. So I put it aside for a few months, and then I started to look into it a little more. And I learned that Lee Silver is far from being alone in this, that if he's a mad scientist, some of the other mad scientists who work with him are people like James Watson, the co-discoverer of the structure of DNA, and Daniel Koshland, the ex-editor of Science magazine. And I learned that in 1998, they and some of their colleagues had organized a public conference at the University of California at Los Angeles that they called Engineering the Human Germline. They drew about 1,000 people to this conference. It was covered in very glowing terms on the front pages of the New York Times, the Washington Post, and other major newspapers. And this conference reportedly had the flavor as much of a political rally as of a scientific gathering. One of the organizers described the event as the kickoff event in the campaign to convince Americans, to sell Americans on the idea of engineering the human germline. And I looked into which groups might be taking on this issue and learned to my dismay that although there were a few individuals and the Committee for Responsible Genetics in Cambridge, really this was not an issue that activists had yet taken up. And so that's what we need to do. I wish I had time to tell you and show you how this topic is covered in the United States media, in Time, in Newsweek, in Scientific American, on television, 60 Minutes, and Ted Koppel's show. It's now become almost like a drumbeat. It's becoming normalized. And the tone of the media messages are quite consistent. It's, well, you know, this technology does pose some ethical difficulties, but what can we do? It's inevitable. And we're hearing that more and more. The media attention has intensified after the announcement last summer of the sequencing of the human genome, the working draft of the human genome. So we need to get going on this issue. And I want to say to you that in Canada, in many countries, and Canada is one of them, these technologies have been addressed on a policy level. Now, not yet in Canada, but in Europe, many countries have outlawed it. In Germany, for example, and in Japan, attempting to clone a human being, a related technology that I haven't had time to talk about, attempting to clone a human being in those two countries is a felony. You go to jail for doing it. In most European countries, this was a no-brainer. It was just assumed that this was a violation of human rights, that this was a horrible technology that could lead to these nightmarish futures, and there's movement in policy circles and in legislative venues to outlaw it. Canada has drafted legislation that would forbid human germline engineering and human cloning, but has not yet enacted it. In the United States, however, where the advocates are most active, there is no legislation whatsoever. And in the media, there are no voices of opposition save those that object to these technologies because they destroy embryos. So the anti-abortion people are heard on this issue, but other activists have not been heard. What we need eventually is a global ban on these two technologies, human germline engineering and human reproductive cloning. That we will need national legislation and regulations. We will need effective, accountable, democratic regulation of many other new genetic and reproductive technologies. And in order to make all those things happen, we'll need nothing less than to build a new social movement that takes this on. This is the task that we have. I hope that people who are now campaigning against genetically modified food can start educating themselves about genetically modified human beings. I hope that people from Canada will understand the importance of countries like Canada in pioneering legislation and in saying to the world community that these are technologies we must forego. This is a vision of the human future that we utterly reject. Thank you.
Thank you. I don't think it was mentioned, but Marcy handed out an article called today genetically modified food, tomorrow genetically modified humans. And this was distributed throughout the theater, so if you get a chance to, if you didn't get a copy, why don't you talk to Marcy after the panelist concluded. Our next speaker is Dr. Gregor Wolbring, who is a biochemist and a bioethicist at the University of Calgary in Alberta. His research looks at how bioethical issues such as euthanasia and biotechnology affect equality rights and the rights of marginalized groups, for example, disabled people, not just in Canada but around the world. He's also the founder and coordinator of the International Network on Bioethics and Disability, which is a network supported by the International Association of Bioethics. He also acts as an advisor both to disability groups and other equality rights groups and organizations and people who deal with bioethical issues. I'm very pleased to introduce Dr. Wolbring, who is going to bring a disability rights perspective to the issues that the panel is addressing. Thank you.
Okay, is this loud enough or? No way, I like more. Okay. Thank you for the nice introduction, and thanks for inviting me. It was a long time that I was the last in Vancouver, and you have blue sky. I don't know how you've done that. I mean, make me really feel like Calgary, right? My talk will look at issues of perception, double morality, double standard, inclusion, and all links this to disability, because I think disability is one of the least, the last bastions in the biotech debate, which are not included. So let's start with perception. Okay. How can a trail running shoe with an outer sole designed like a goat's hoof help me avoid compressing my spinal cord into a slinky on the side of some unsuspecting conifer, thereby rendering me a drooling, misshapen, non-extreme trail running husk of my former self, forced to roam the earth in a motorized wheelchair with my name embossed on one of those cute little license plates you get at carnivals and or state fairs, fastened to the back. This is a newest ad from Nike to sell their shoes. It came out in October 2000 in most of the Backpacker magazine and so on. This is a reflection very much of how society views disability. And as long as you have that perception of disability, you will never win your war against human genetics. You have to work on perception to change this. Because, and I mean, we could also go differently. For example, I realized recently that I suffer from a genetic condition. Also, I have not actually had my genome screened. All the anatomical signs of a double X syndrome are here. And while I could probably handle the myriad physiological disorders associated with my condition, bouts of pain and bleeding coming and going for decades, hair growth patterns that obviously differ from normal people's, the social downsides associated with it are troubling. This is, of course, a description of being a woman. Right? So the question is, do you want to be perceived in a medical framework, be viewed as a double X syndrome? As soon as you are, you have a hard fight to be accepted within society. So that is the difference between women and ethnic and disabled people. We still have to be accepted for what we are without being viewed in a very demeaning fashion. So that would be the first task you guys actually have to work on, to change perception. Next is precipitation. The reality is that within the biotech framework, you will see very few disabled people part of the debate. I mean, I'm lucky to have at least saw one more disabled person in the audience, so we are already two now. In Boston, we were only one, which was me. So we are actually exponential, we are going up, so. But I mean, in essence, you have to work, you have to reach out to these groups. If you don't understand disability culture, and how this all links together, you will have a hard time if you want to move from food biotech into human biotech, because perception is absolutely important. You have to understand what you're against. And for this, you have to immerse yourself in disability culture and to hear their perception of themselves and how they view themselves. And you might have to re-evaluate how you view disability, defects, disease, and what this all means. Another one is, of course, double morality, which I want to just illustrate with one example. And that is prenatal testing. Of course, prenatal testing will be increasing much faster than any development of germline gene therapy, because the tests already are here, some for decades, and we get more and more. The question is, where do you develop a framework of regulating these tests? For which tests would you like use? Like, would you like use just tests for Tay-Sachs, which is the terminal you die after 2 years condition? Or would you use this for beta thalassemia, which is treatable but very expensive? Or would you draw the line at a Down syndrome because, I mean, Down syndrome, they're not independent, which of course is adamant in the society. We all believe in self-sufficiency and self-reliance, right? So if you're not independent, I mean, it's of course a problem. Or would you go for someone like dwarfism, right, who has is independent but maybe still has some other problems perception-wise with society? Where would you draw the line? What regulatory framework you want the government to have, if you ever can design one, to draw a line somewhere? You have to ask yourself the questions. And when you look around, you will find the only line drawn so far is between sex, which is women very likely, and disability. Sex selection is the only reason in the moment in regulatory frameworks to be used, to be prohibited to use the tests. So, in the moment, it's therefore only sex again. That's why I used the two examples of women and disability. But what arguments would they use to justify that only sex selection should be prohibited from testing, but anything else, in essence, is open? Right? And these are groups like the WHO draft guideline on bioethics say sex selection should be prohibited. The pre-implantation diagnostic guideline in the UK says this. The former Bill C-47, which was the Canadian biotech bill, says this. The Dutch government just introduced the biotech bill, which prohibits sex selection, and so on and so on. So what arguments would they use to justify this distinction? Dorothy Worth and Joseph Fletcher, two bioethicists, argue that sex selection lowers the status of women in general and perpetuates the situations that gave rise to it. I agree with that. Indeed, if you target a certain characteristic for elimination, that must have some impact of how you view that characteristic who is living with this. But would that be permissible, this argument, just for sex? Couldn't that be, in essence, be used for any other characteristic you are targeting? I mean, if this principle is valid, then it has to be, I mean, not just be used for sex, because, I mean, the same principle of prejudice increase would be valid for any other characteristic you're targeting. The Royal Commission of New Reproductive Technologies said, which is a Canadian Royal Commission, said that sex selection is against the principle of human life and dignity and against Canadian values. Now, that would assume, then, that disability selection doesn't belong to the same principle of human life and dignity and Canadian values. And that would assume that I don't belong to the Canadian society because I'm not part of your values. There was no outcry, and the report came out with these kind of arguments. Maybe indeed I don't belong into the society. The Canadian government said sex selection is a sort of sex discrimination. Indeed it is. But then testing for everything is a sort of discrimination. So do we have a two-tier discrimination system now, one where discrimination is permissible and one where isn't? I think you have to, I mean, further and look at these kind of issues. Now, let's assume that we indeed find a gay gene, which we don't have yet. I mean, James Watson is, of course, on record saying that we should also then allow testing for gays. So in the moment, then, it would mean that sex we don't test for, but in essence, sexual orientation and disability we do. But when you look at the arguments, is that the gay community says the same thing as the women groups. We should not test for no sexual orientation now, because it increases prejudice and so on. They're coming with the same kind of arguments that they're using for prohibition of sex selection. But then they're coming out and saying that there's this analogy between the arguments I made, and this is from a paper of Ed Stein, against the permissibility of orientation selection procedures and the proposed argument against the permissibility of using genetic technology to prevent the birth of babies with serious disorders. Now, CS disorders, of course, is used all the time, but no one ever defines what it is, right? So is dwarfism a CS disorder? Is Down syndrome? Is Tay-Sachs? I mean, it's a nice, convenient word, and everyone can fill it with their own limit, and so you're home free. Such disorders may dramatically decrease life expectancy, cause great suffering, and intrinsically undermine a person's quality of life. Further, a person with such a condition would say she wishes she did not have this condition. Homosexuality and bisexuality are not like this. In particular, the primary negative feature of being a lesbian, gay, man, or bisexual have to do with societal attitudes towards their sexual orientation, not with intrinsic features of them. What this argument reflects is the distinction between viewing disability as a medical problem and therefore looking for a medical cure, which is termination or gene therapy, whereas you view then sexual orientation as a societal problem. Right? Now, of course, there's a lot of literature out from the disability study scholars who say that disability is a social construct, that disability is not a medical problem. Right? But of course, it gets never heard. And also, I mean, when Ed Stein can say it's not intrinsic, as soon as you go for a gene, it's intrinsic to you because your gene and no one else's. So that you can publish this kind of illogical stuff in academic journals is a reflection that none of the groups who are targeted, like disabled people, are part of the debate. We are not part of the academic debate either for the most part, so we can't even challenge it. Right, I think you have also to work on that, and you have to, I mean, really, I mean, it's a totally different ballgame than food biotech, what you're going up here. And I think if you go on viewing disability as a medical problem, whether it's then sex or sexual orientation as a associated problem, you will end up in deep trouble because, in essence, everything can be viewed, depending where the power can then decide what is a medical problem. Right? It's not necessarily a rational decision because why would I be a medical problem? Right? Only because I have no legs. Right? This is not per se a medical problem. The problem is that they're for the most part there, so it's a societal problem. And therefore I want for myself social cures, which is the same as the gay community, and not a medical cure getting rid of me. So you have to think about that. And of course, Andrew Braun of Amnesty International said, discussing testing for Down syndrome, if society regards the presence of such disease as an acceptable reason for aborting a fetus, this makes it harder to preserve equality of respect for those already born. One might argue that their human worth, if not their human rights, have been diminished. And indeed, I think if for sex and sexual orientation this argument holds, then it should also hold for disability. Okay, now. Now, I just want to give you some quote of disabled people because they're normally coming right too short in this whole debate. First, we start with some others. I mean, one of the reasons for that you have to fight the medical model is because there are enough people out there who are trying to enforce the medical model and try to enforce a morality which says you have to do the right thing, which means you have to get rid of disability. Your argument, your perception of choice, I think, You will learn in the future that society will tell you what to do. There will not be much of a choice because you will just have to do the responsible thing, especially then if you get no support systems anymore. And this is not just me. I mean, look at, for example, Dr. Margaret Thompson, Order of Canada member and former president of the Genetic Society of Canada. And she was a defense witness for the Alberta government in the Lavinia Muir sterilization case. And she said, some causes of mental defectiveness are hereditary, and when the eugenics board was created, there was a real danger of passing on those causes because contraceptive choices were limited. Today, people at risk of inheriting or passing on a defect to their children have the pill and other contraceptives available. They can seek genetic counseling before a child is born and can abort a child likely to be defective. So in essence, what you have here is the technique is changing, but the sentiment is still the same. So in the folder you got, there's a whole, there's one list, one article in there which talks about what disabled people demand. So you can look up there what they demand, but just give you, as you can see, I had much more with me. Okay, just give you like, couple of quotes. Disabled people, like there was a big conference in the UK of disabled people and from like 23 countries, and they demanded following. First and foremost, we demand nothing about us without us. They said, We are full human beings. We believe a society without disabled people would be a lesser society. Our unique individual and collective experience are an important contribution to a rich human society. We demand an end to the biomedical elimination of diversity, to gene selection based on market forces, and to the setting of norms and standards by non-disabled people. They say, up until now, most of us having been excluded from the debates on bioethical issues. These debates have been prejudiced and negative views of our quality of life. They have denied our right to equality and have therefore denied our human rights. We demand that we are all included in all debates and policy making regarding bioethical issues, which, by the way, is also written in the World Conference on Science declarations of the, which was sponsored by the UNESCO. And so far, for example, the Canadian Biotech Advisory Committee has no disabled person or indigenous person on their committee. And this is a committee which is supposed to advise the government on what the society feels about biotech. And you exclude on this committee two groups who are the major forces of this society. And so I'll give you another one from the Spina Bifida conference. It says, adult and the parents of the conference stated that people with spina bifida and hydrocephalus live a full life with equal value to that of any other citizen. Adults with spina bifida stated very clearly that their quality of life is not a reason for abortion. Parents and adults stated that the impairment is not a burden. The burden is a constant struggle against inaccessible environments and inadequate systems, which should be the ally and supportive of them. Okay, so more or less I'm stopping here. All of this talk, in essence, tries to give you a different perspective of what disability views and how they're looking into the biotech field. And you have still other, I mean, there's still more questions to come. For example, if you perceive, when you go on with a negative perception of disability, what happens in countries who don't have the technology? Right? What would happen in Africa? Because they can't afford the technology. But if they buy in the same negative perception we are now nurturing with the technology here, would they increase, for example, infanticide because they have no other option? And there's already, philosophical frameworks out there who say that indeed they should, right? Because it's not that you target a certain person or fetus, you target a characteristic. And if you can't do it earlier, then indeed you have the moral rights and moral, leverage to do it then later, whenever you can get rid of this characteristic. This is another thing. This gets into the euthanasia debate, which, of course, we don't go now. But there's much more complexity. And I really urge you to get more into the issues from looking at the disability rights perspective. Look at how these issues are linked together. The webpage I have, which is also in your handout, gives you a very good connection between all kind of different issues. And I hope that you work together with the disability groups here in town, seek them out, work with them, because in 50 minutes I can only say so much. We have more than 50 minutes for that done. But right, there's much more to it. And it's not me. You have to seek them out on local levels, work with them, immerse yourself, and then learn and rethink your perceptions. Thanks.
You've been listening to a panel, For Whose Benefit? Biomedical Research, Pharmaceuticals, Genetic Screening, and the Human Genome Project, which was part of the Big Money Bad Science Teach-In on Biotechnology held in Vancouver, Canada last month. The panelists were Arthur Teutcher, MD, Dr. Marcy Darnofsky, and Dr. Gregor Walbring. Our Big Money Bad Science series continues next week with a look at the propaganda techniques used by the biotech industry and what citizen activists are doing to take control of their food supply back. Thanks to the Vancouver Independent Media Center for recording these forums. The music featured in today's program was by Seize the Day. Seize the Day has a website, www.seizetheday.org.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.